Our second reading is from Matthew 12, verses 1 to 14. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." He went on from there and entered their synagogue. And a man was there with a withered hand. And they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" so that they might accuse him. He said to them, "Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the man stretched it out, and it was restored, healthy like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him, how to destroy him. The word of the Lord.
You know, we start at a very early age learning to follow rules. You can see this in any elementary school classroom or room that you enter in. There's rules for how to behave in the classroom, in the hallway, and of course, in the cafeteria. Look around at some of the signs on the wall here. As some of the people love these signs in here. Raise your hand if you need anything. Stay in your seat, okay? Eat only your food. That might be the best one, right? There's rules for outside. Stay visible at all times when you're outside at recess. This is recess expectations. Use equipment for its intended purpose. There's a lot of room for interpretation in those. You know, what's amazing is kids who haven't even been in a schoolroom setting, they often, when they first enter, they're challenged by some of these rules, but within a few weeks, they tend to pick it up. And by the time a kid is in second or third grade, they know to stay in their seat. They know that their teacher said, when you're walking in the hallway, you're supposed to be quiet. What's phenomenal is the way that kids will even increase those rules. They become self-policers and self-lawmakers where, you know, the teacher might have said, "We need to be quiet when they're in the hallway," and a kid will turn to another kid and say, "Remember, we're not supposed to even talk in the hallway." They'll add to it, and they get on each other's case. And that's probably because kids want to succeed. They want to do well, right? They learn pretty quickly that if you follow the rules, you stay out of trouble. And the other thing is true as well is when it comes to kind of success, for instance, in the classroom, you need to follow the instructions. Somewhere along the way, they learn that when a project is given and instructions are given with that project, it's good to follow the instructions. When you do, you get the A. Keep the rules, follow the instructions, and you'll stay out of trouble. You'll get the A. Many of us and many people outside of a room like this think that's essentially what Christianity is. A set of instructions, a set of rules that if you follow them, if you keep them, you won't get in trouble in the end. You'll kind of get the A. Jesus wants to overthrow all ideas that Christianity is about a set of instructions you're supposed to follow. We see that time and again, and we see it especially this morning in Matthew chapter 12. Jesus gets in a lot of trouble regarding the Sabbath day, the day of rest. Because Jesus seems to be throwing out all the instructions and breaking all the rules. And we have to wonder, what is Jesus up to? As kind of a brief summary before we enter it, Jesus is redefining the Sabbath. And he's redefining it in himself. He's saying, "I am here to offer you the kind of rest that the religious can never find in following their rules. So let's kind of enter this, see how Jesus does it, and see if maybe it offers us, who sometimes need a little bit of rest, any word of hope. So what we see in our passage is Jesus, of course, getting in trouble for breaking the rules of the Sabbath. In the first couple of verses of Matthew 12, Jesus and his disciples on a Sabbath day are walking through a field. The disciples are hungry, and so they stop to pick grains of wheat or something, and they're kind of rubbing it in their hands and getting the seeds, and they're eating basically some seeds as they're walking along. The Pharisees, the religious leaders of the time, see this happening and say to Jesus, "Why is it that you allow your disciples to do what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus then defends them with a very rabbinic argument. He says, "You know how David, King David, when he was hungry with his men, ate the food they were not supposed to eat, the bread from the temple." And then he goes on to say, and think about this, the priests every week, they desecrate the temple because they desecrate the Sabbath because they go in and offer sacrifices. And you're not supposed to do any work on the Sabbath day. And so he kind of makes this argument and defends his disciples. Jesus' argument sounds actually a lot like rabbinic arguments. Back in that day, rabbis would get at each other's throats over who had the best interpretation of the rules. And they would write long defined, you know, legal arguments of how you were supposed to carry out certain things. And the Sabbath was included in this. It had lots of different disagreements on how you would interpret it. But roughly speaking, the rabbis had the same kind of basic general area that they were arguing from. And in some ways, Jesus seems to be saying something along these lines. He's just kind of offering his own reinterpretation. The story goes on where Jesus and his disciples then enter the synagogue in that local village, and there's a man there with a shriveled up hand, right? And the rabbis, the Pharisees, say, "Aha, here's a chance to push Jesus one more time." They say, "Jesus, is it lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath? Because you're not supposed to do any work." And Jesus says, "It's always lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Why not wait till the next day?" But Jesus is kind of reinterpreting the Sabbath, right? And so he heals the man. The man stretches out his hand, and it's restored to wholeness by Jesus. Now, to really understand why Jesus gets in so much trouble, it's helpful to know what the Sabbath meant to a first century Jew. The Sabbath was of fundamental importance to first century Judaism. It was one of the key identity markers for Jews in the way that they defined themselves against their pagan and godless neighbors. The three main categories of kind of marking were circumcision, dietary laws, kosher food, and the Sabbath keeping. Those three things defined you as a fearer of God, somebody who worshiped Yahweh, somebody who understood God and wanted to follow him. Everyone else was a pagan, godless person. But circumcision, dietary laws, and the Sabbath. But as the religious leaders were defining it by that day, the laws became something you had to obey. Not just a bunch of rules, but rules with rules under the rules. It was so much so that there's a collection of writings called the Mishnah, which is really a collection of the way the rabbis interpreted the law. And in that, there's one tractate on the Sabbath. And that tractate on the Sabbath has 39 specific, deeply defined rules of what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath. They're taking from the Old Testament law and extrapolating out a whole series of rules you had to follow. Rule number 16 is the one that Jesus broke. That is the rule against harvesting on the Sabbath. There's a modern Orthodox commentary on this Mishnah, and it's talking about why you're not allowed to reap or harvest on the Sabbath, says this: "The prohibition against reaping and harvesting on the Sabbath also includes cutting or plucking any growing thing. Such activities as plucking a flower and plucking a fruit from a tree come under this heading. The same is true of mowing a lawn. It was also legislated that we do not handle any growing flowers or plants on the Sabbath. It is also forbidden to climb a tree or smell a growing flower on the Sabbath. Fruit which falls from a tree on the Sabbath may not be used on the same day. The use of animals is forbidden, since there is concern that one might forget that it's the Sabbath and inadvertently pluck a branch for use as a switch, which would be a form of reaping the branch. Jesus, what in the world are you doing allowing your disciples to harvest on the Sabbath? Don't you know the law? Don't you know the rules? By the time of Jesus' day, the law of God, which was meant to be a blessing, to draw people to God, to guide them to see who God was, to be a light to the nations, had instead become a bunch of very high walls. Israel had made itself into a fortress to keep out the pagans. Instead of using the laws of God to define them as a lighthouse to show the goodness and greatness of God to those who did not know him. The Sabbath was not meant to be a burdensome thing with a bunch of rules added on top of it. It was actually meant to be a blessing. If you go back to how the Sabbath was instituted by God through Genesis and then later in the covenant, we see a couple of things that come out. The Sabbath is meant to be an opportunity for worship, because worship is essentially reflecting who God is. God worked for 6 days, and on the seventh, he rested. Therefore, you who are made in God's image are meant to work and rest. The Sabbath is also meant to be a point of hope for the people of Israel, because life is hard. Work is hard. And the Sabbath was meant to point to that day that was going to come when God would come to right all wrongs, to give us a final rest from our trials and labors in this world. So it was meant to be a foretaste of eternity and to give you great hope that one day you would rest forever. So every Sabbath is meant to be a taste of eternity. And third, the Sabbath was meant to be, quite simply, a time of restoration. This is the most obvious one, right? Every day you have a Sabbath when you close your eyes and fall asleep. That is a gift from God. You know what it's like when you're really, really tired and you finally get to lay down and close your eyes? That is what the Sabbath is meant to be. A chance to just stop for a few hours and be physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually restored. Jesus says, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. That's a simple way of understanding that the Sabbath is meant for whatever increases worship, causes people to hope in God, and allows us to be restored to wholeness. So, of course, healing somebody on the Sabbath or eating food is okay. But by Jesus' day, the Sabbath had become a burden instead of a blessing. It was a series of rules that you had to follow, you had to perform, you had to keep up with. And that's because what was essentially in place as Jesus entered the world was religion. And we talk about this a lot in here, the difference between religion and the gospel. But what you see in the way that the rabbis, that the religious leaders are trying to define what it means to rest in God, is that you have to perform and obey in order to achieve rightness with God. And that's the fundamental truth behind basically every religion out there. Every religion has this fundamental idea that if you're good enough or you perform what's expected of you, God or whatever it is that you believe in will accept you. Some religious systems are built on basic morality. So if you're good enough, you will be accepted by God. In other systems, it's more of kind of the karmic thing. You've got to have enough good to outweigh your bad for, in the end, the good to kind of get you into the next thing. Or even in religions that have a less personal God, where it's really you're trying to achieve transcendence, you're still trying to go through a series of hoops that you personally have to achieve in order to get to that place of transcendence. You must perform. And of course, anything that causes us to live on the basis of our performance is going to fill us with anxiety and guilt. I mean, we know what this is like. We know the anxiety and guilt of religion because when we fall short, we feel really, really bad. And we'll beat ourselves up. Because essentially what we're doing is we're comparing ourselves with one another and we think, well, right now I'm not measuring up as a dad. Or I kind of broke these rules that I have for myself. And we get filled with anxiety or guilt or the opposite, superiority, when we're doing everything just right. We feel great about ourselves. But in the end, religion is always making sure that you've done enough. The gospel is that Jesus has done enough for us. I am terrible at baking bread or baking anything. And that's because I'm not a rule follower when it comes to baking or cooking, right? And if any of you know and like to bake, you find out that they actually expect you, I've heard, to measure things when you're baking. You know, 2.5 cups doesn't mean 2.5 cups. It means 2.5 cups. When you follow the rules in baking, when you follow the recipe, you end up with the right kind of bread. But every detail matters. Religion is a recipe that you must follow. And if you don't follow it exactly, your bread is not going to be right. The religious leaders of Jesus' day argued about who had the best recipe, who followed it the right way, whose bread was turning out the best. Religion is a recipe that you have to follow exactly. The gospel and what Jesus offers is bread for the hungry. Religion says, measure precisely or you will fail and starve in the end. The gospel says, take, eat. This is my body which is given for you. Do you see the difference? The gospel is not instructions. It is life-changing news. Now, most of us don't live with life-changing news. We think of news as what's on CNN or what's in the newspaper. But the gospel is fundamentally good news, but it's good news which transforms our life. And when I was trying to understand what might be the equivalent of the gospel or good news that transforms our life, what I thought about was being a second, third, fourth grader. And those mornings that I would wake up in the winter when the night before Bob Ryan, the weatherman, had said it was going to snow. And when you wake up early, and I would wake up at a godforsaken early hour on those mornings, pull open the shades and look out and see white everywhere. The next move was to run downstairs, turn on the local channel, and see if the news was there. Snow day. Fairfax County schools are canceled. That is life-changing news. Because think about it. That is the kind of news that causes a third grader to rejoice in the entire day. Because you don't have to go to school. Instead, you can go outside and you can go sledding and throw snowballs and dig snow tunnels and then come in for hot chocolate and then go out and do it again. A snow day is life-transforming news for a third grader. Religion is, if I do enough good stuff, maybe it'll snow. The gospel is, it's a snow day. Enjoy. That's what the Sabbath was meant to be. Not something you have to perform, but something you get to simply enjoy and celebrate and rest in. Hear, believe the good news. And enjoy it. You know, Jesus' defense of his disciples and of healing the man, I said it sounds a lot like a rabbinic argument. And back in that day, rabbis would always have arguments about their interpretation of the law. And so some religious studies professors will say Jesus was simply another rabbi who came along and offered another interpretation of the law. Now, his was a little bit more progressive, kind of like Hillel compared to Shammai, these two ancient Jewish rabbis. And so he was really just following the same sort of argument. He came in and said, here's my interpretation. But the problem with that is that Hillel never tried to have Shammai killed. But the rabbis, the religious leaders who heard Jesus this day, it says in verse 14 of Matthew 12 that they wanted to destroy Jesus. Having a different legal interpretation does not cause you to want to destroy Jesus. What was it that Jesus was saying and doing? Well, I would say this. If you read through Matthew 12 here, Jesus is not making an argument for how to properly understand the instructions of the Sabbath. He is giving a declaration. He is not trying to compare something that happened in the past to what he was doing. He is saying there is a fulfillment of all that was in the past. The argument goes something like this. In verses 3 and 4, he says, hey, look, you remember how David, when he was hungry with his men, did something he was not supposed to do? He went into the temple and ate the bread that was there for the Lord. One greater than David is in your midst. The true King and Messiah is here. He goes on to say in verse 5, the priests, every Sabbath day, when they offer their sacrifices, are doing work on the Sabbath. They break the Sabbath. He's not saying because they can, we can. He's saying one greater than the priests is here. The true high priest is here. The one who mediates between God the holy and man the sinful is here in your presence. And we know that's what he's saying because he finishes it off with the most condemning of statements, the most radical of statements when he says, something greater than the temple is here. The temple was the most holy place in all of Israel because in the temple, God dwelt. Before the temple, they had the tabernacle, which was kind of the moving tent or temple. And that word tabernacle in the Old Testament is actually the same word as dwell. And the idea is this: God dwells with you in the tabernacle. In the temple, the Israelites believed God dwelt with them. Jesus comes along and says, God is dwelling with you, and here I am. Emmanuel, God with you. Something greater than the temple is here. I am Lord of the Sabbath. That's a divine claim. Jesus is saying, the Creator is the one who established the Sabbath by creating and resting. I'm here. Yahweh, the God of Israel, gave the covenant to Moses, which said you're supposed to honor the Sabbath day. I am the one who gave that covenant. I am here. Jesus is not just redefining the Sabbath. He's redefining it in himself. Later on in Colossians 2:17, Paul writes, the Sabbath is a shadow for which Christ is the substance. The Sabbath was meant to point to, but find its fulfillment in Jesus. Writing about this passage, Pastor Tim Keller says, Jesus has not come simply to reform religion, but to end it and replace it with himself. In Genesis 2:2, God establishes the covenant, and he says, or establishes the Sabbath, and he says, and on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. Listen to what that says. God finished his work, and he rested. God did not rest because he was tired, he was worn out, he was plumb tuckered from all that hard work he had done. He rested because he was finished. It was complete. It had reached its telos, its goal, its end, its wholeness. And so he rested because he was satisfied. Which is why God says, it is good, it is very good. And he rested. But you know what's interesting? What happens on the eighth day of creation? There is no eighth day. The implication is that God is still in that seventh day of rest. God entered into that place of satisfaction, and he remains there eternally. Jesus, as Lord of the Sabbath, invites us into God's ongoing Sabbath. We did not read this passage, but it's the verses that directly precede our passage here. It's in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, where Jesus is actually talking about work and rest, the Sabbath, right? This is what Jesus says. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Come to me, Jesus says, and I will give you rest. You know, there was a way of referring to following the law, the Torah, that was actually being yoked to the Torah, being yoked to the law. That was the Jewish understanding of being a disciple and a Pharisee and a religious follower, was to be yoked to the law. By Jesus' day, the law had become a burdensome yoke. Religion adds the burdens of 39 extra meticulous details and instructions of what you need to do. Jesus comes along and throws it off. But of course, there's this challenging part, is there's times when Jesus seems to be adding to the law. In the Sermon on the Mount, what does Jesus say? He says, you have heard it said, do not commit murder. But I say, if you have hate in your heart, if you are feeling anger towards somebody, if you call somebody a fool or an idiot or a bad name, you have already murdered them. That sounds like Jesus is adding to the law. He's making it more burdensome. How can Jesus' yoke be easier? Jesus' yoke is easier because even as he calls us to a deeper, more profound holiness, he calls us to the sort of thing we cannot accomplish on our own by rules. You know, you can avoid murdering somebody by not actually murdering them. Don't actually kill them, okay? You can have instructions about how to keep safe distance so you don't accidentally murder somebody. But rules alone cannot change your heart. You will always fall short. But Jesus says, what I have laid on you is not burdensome. Why? Because Jesus bears the burden himself in our place. Jesus is the burden carrier. Think about it this way. At creation, God finished his work and rested. On the cross, God, when the work of paying for our sin and failure was done, he cried out, "It is finished." And we who believe that's true get to rest. Jesus is offering himself as the Sabbath to all of us who deal with guilt and anxiety of trying to live up to a certain moral performance, to all of us who wrestle with superiority and judgmentalness, to all of us who just have the burden of a life that is just hard. He offers us Sabbath in him. He says, you are accepted before God, not because of how well you've performed the duties, but by my work, not yours. Come to me, he says. Believe in me is what that means, and experience rest. The Sabbath, like the gospel, is meant to be a blessing, like fresh baked bread. You know, every Sunday we finish with the Lord's Supper. And at the table, we have a picture of the gospel, don't we? It's not instructions about what you must do in order to bake the bread, although somebody has to do that. It's simply take, eat. I have been given for you. Believe feast on me and enjoy the Sabbath rest now and forever. Let's pray. Many of us, Lord, need rest. We work so hard for weekends and for vacations. We work so hard to keep up in school and on the field. We need rest. But all the rest that we have in every weekend and snow day and vacation is just a shadow of the deeper rest, the ongoing Sabbath that you offer us in your Son, where we are finally made right with God, where we can rest in the work that was done for us, the one who carried our burdens, who worked on the cross for us and said, "It is finished." May we rest in him this morning. Amen.
To him.